Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the journalist and writer Joel Shalit on the subject of anti-immigrant and racist violence in Europe. And then towards the bottom of the hour, a long interview with Saadi Attour, author of a newish book on Pakistan, a country that's much in the news lately. Before that, some comments on the economic news, in this case, the March employment report that came out on Friday morning. Employers added 120,000 jobs in March, a disappointingly low number by recent standards. It may be that the strength we saw earlier in the year was the result of unusually warm weather in much of the country, and this crummy figure is just some payback. The headline number was dragged down by a few unusually weak sectors, notably department stores and temp firms. A continuing bright spot, though, is manufacturing, which has been on the upswing now for a couple of years, putting in its best extended performance since the mid-1990s. The unemployment rate fell from 8.3% to 8.2%, its lowest level in 3 years. Unfortunately, that was all because people dropped out of the labor force, meaning they stopped looking actively for work and therefore are not accounted as officially unemployed. The share of the population working also fell, reversing last month's increase. Monthly job gains of over 200,000, which is what we saw in January and February, though really only about average or even slightly less by historical standards, felt good for a while. So I hope that this really is just a weather-related anomaly and not a reversion to the mid-2011 sluggishness. We're still over 5 million jobs below the pre-recession peak. At this rate, it would take 3.5 years to regain them, not allowing even for any population growth. But as I've said before, recoveries from financial crises are typically very frustrating, and the latest employment report looks like one of those frustrations. I don't see any sign yet that we're slipping back into recession, though that's always a possibility. The larger story is that the U.S. economy remains quite sick, and the modest recovery we've seen so far has done nothing to address the longer-term issues. But I'll have to stop here, since there's a lot of interview material ahead. Back after a musical break to discuss ugliness in Europe. Some of Europa Endlos, Europe Endless by Kraftwerk. My first guest is Joel Shalit. Joel is the author of several books, most recently Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books. He's also the co-editor of a fine new webzine on culture and politics, Souciant, Souciant.com, as in caring, the opposite of insouciant. Though he spent most of his life in Israel and the U.S., he's been living in various parts of Europe for the last few years, giving him a chance to put his academic background in the study of nationalism to good use as anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim discrimination and violence become more prominent in the old world. We start by talking about the recent shooting at the Jewish school in Toulouse, France, but as Joel reminds us, it wasn't a simple act of anti-Semitism that many are reading it as. Joel Shalit. Welcome, Joel. First of all, the school shooting in Toulouse was remarkable, but it's provoked some rather ugly reactions, too. So what's your analysis of what's going on in France?
The political environment in France right now, as far as race is concerned and religion, is absolutely toxic. It's no surprise that these killings took place and that they had it. Not only a high number of victims, but victims from all manner of minority background. The kind of environment that the UMP and the National Front, the UMP is the party of Nicolas Sarkozy, the current president. The UMP and the National Front have proven their expertise at whipping up racial and anti-immigrant hysteria in the country. Though I don't think they were quite prepared for a minority Frenchman to have taken the kind of violent actions that he did.
But now this also seems to be validating a lot of anti-Muslim feeling too, right?
The assumption has been that Mohamed Merah's killings would validate the anti-immigrant positions of the two largest conservative parties in the country and irrevocably influence the outcome of the upcoming elections in their favor. But polling so far has suggested that the left will indeed still win this election and that economic concerns remain paramount amongst the French, which is very interesting. I spent the last 10 days monitoring French media very closely, and all of the pundits on the major networks and all of the opinion makers in the newspapers were absolutely convinced that Mohamed Merah had just bought the election for Marine Le Pen and Nicolas Sarkozy, and so far, the polls are showing the exact opposite.
Now, could it be, as the Oklahoma bombing here was kind of the end of the militia movement, was this shockingly excessive and might have a paradoxically opposite effect?
That's what we're hoping, and I think that's what a lot of people on the center-left and are hoping and immigration advocates are hoping. I think that the French feel really stunned, and while the French can be accused of their own version of national provincialism and hostility to cultural pluralism, I think that the anti-immigrant rhetoric and the anti-Muslim rhetoric of the right is not in correspondence with the national mood. And so we're hoping here in Europe that this assumption is indeed correct and that the left has done, the center left at least, has done a good enough job at negating the appeal of populism and anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Of course, the targets were Jews. And what about anti-Semitism in France and elsewhere in Europe? How rampant and serious is it?
Well, remember that two of the other victims, if I'm correct, one of them was North African and the other was Afro-Caribbean. So Mohamed Merah seemed to be taking it out on everyone within the minority community, not just, as the media emphasized, his victims were not solely Jews.
But it was a Jewish school.
It was a Jewish school, and according to the newspapers, apparently, he had not originally intended to attack the Jewish school, but had missed his target for the day and ended up, he was nearby this Jewish academy and proceeded to focus on these Jewish kids instead.
Now, the American right is doing a lot of I told you so's about this.
Yeah, of course. And it's validating a lot of people on the Israeli right as well, who say that Europe remains one big graveyard for Jews and the Europe's largest Jewish community, the French Jewish community, which is, you know, I believe approximately around 700,000 people, should just pack up and move back home.
You know? Home being Israel.
Yeah, even though, you know.
That's not the way the flow of traffic is going, though, is it?
Well, there are a lot of Israelis immigrating to the United States, but I think there's a negative outflow of Jews from Europe pretty much everywhere. I don't think it's as large as the Israeli migration to the U.S. or to Berlin, for that matter, my hometown. But there is a negative outflow, and events like this don't help.
Now, is the economic crisis in Europe having an effect of intensifying anti-immigrant feelings and internal racial conflict?
It's having the effect of amplifying anti-everything feelings. And, of course, ethnic minorities like Muslims and like Jews are feeling it very, very strongly. Right after the killings in Toulouse, the Haaretz, the Israeli center-left daily, published an article about a new poll. I believe it was commissioned by the ADL. About rising anti-Semitism in France. And while I normally dismiss anything that I read from the ADL, I find the ADL, even though I sympathize with their work and I have friends who work for them, I tend to find their efforts a little hysterical and politically oriented in ways that I'm not comfortable with. these numbers were probably correct. And I think that the atmosphere that it's documenting is typical of a generally hostile atmosphere towards minorities in France at present. And that this can be compared to general animosity towards minorities in other European countries. Like, if you take a poll like that and you compare it to, for example, there was a recently concluded study in Germany documenting a really widespread rise in Islamophobia across, you know, the German middle class, if I'm correct. So, you know, you can't separate the results of these studies in these respective countries from each other. They are essentially documenting nationally specific responses to the same phenomenon.
Let's talk about the other countries you spent some time in, Italy and Germany. First, Italy, what are things like there?
Italy has a very, very big immigrant community, and I think by 2040 or 2050, a recent study that was whose results were published in La Repubblica, Italy's version of The Guardian, I guess you could call it, center-left newspaper published in Rome. The results of the study indicated that up to 25% of Italians would be of minority background. I think 10% are right now. I've seen figures between 7 and 10%. And there's a lot of anti-immigrant feeling in Italy that's been here for a while. It was anti-immigrant rhetoric was an enormous part of the political rhetoric of the Berlusconi government, which folded in November. And it remains an essential component of the platform of the Northern League, which was a coalition partner in the Berlusconi government, and which is local to northern Italy, where we are currently working, and is largely, I think, responsible for a very popular anti-immigrant environment that you can discern in all of the major cities in the north. Milan's the worst. We lived in Milano for you know, a little over a year, and it was just remarkable how tense it was racially. We've talked about this before. Torino as well is a little more welcoming where we are currently working. It's a little more welcoming to immigrants, for example. But back in late November, early December, there was a horrific racially motivated attack on African immigrants in Florence, which killed several, I believe, Senegalese immigrants who were working the Christmas markets. And this guy came from a relatively new, at least to outsiders, organization, fascist organization called Casa Pound. And Casa Pound are...
As in Ezra?
Yeah, they're named after Ezra Pound, and apparently Ezra Pound, I think his daughter is still alive, has in the wake of these killings has initiated some kind of a lawsuit to prevent them from using her father's name. Casa Pound are a self-styled neo-Nazi or explicitly Nazi organization, which are heavily influenced by autonomous Marxism and anti-capitalist organizations. Squat buildings and have hardcore bands and whatnot. And they have a charismatic leader who's kind of like you would get, it's comparable to an Italian Ian Stewart. You remember Ian Stewart from Screwdriver?
Mm.
His name is Gianluca. Oh God, I can't remember his full name. Anyway, they're based in Rome and they are very successful at recruiting young people to what is probably the most rationally organized neo-Nazi organization in Italy that leverages a historic skinhead culture. And boy, do they hate black people. Oof.
I'm speaking with Joel Chalit, who is, among other things, editor of the webzine Souciante, which everyone should check out, of course. Let's go back to what you just said. They're influenced by autonomous Marxism and
yeah.
A lot of the culture, you know, what we associate with left radical anarchism. How does that work out? Could you do the ideology analysis for us?
They're very fundamentally anti-capitalist, and they're very interested in a benevolent public sector, and they're very scared of government at the same time. They embody all the contradictions of the post-1960s autonomous and Marxist left. But ultimately, they're not necessarily interested in democracy or social or cultural pluralism, and like many Italian fascists, has studied the left very closely and manages to, assimilate certain kinds of left tendencies within an overall anti-democratic project.
Well, I guess there's a precedent for that in Mussolini.
That's absolutely correct. Yes, 100%. They are classic Italian fascists in that. I find them very interesting, because of their relationship to punk culture. Italy has a very strong and historic punk community. There's still a lot of great punk bands here, and there's a very active left-wing squatting culture here. And having worked in the record business, squats were one of the few places I could put bands through regularly or artists through in the early 00s American artists could get paid and actually get responsible tours taken care of throughout Italy. I remain very fond of the Italian left scene, as fractured and messed up as it is.
And now what about Germany? The economic crisis has so far spared Germany, and it's lording it over the rest of Europe. But what's the internal atmosphere like? And it's not a good time to be of Turkish origin in Germany, is it?
On Wednesday night, there were, as we were discussing before we started the interview, there was a killing in my neighborhood, the neighborhood of Neukölln in southeastern Berlin. It's right on the border with East Berlin. It's a very very ethnically mixed community. 20% Muslim population are the estimates. 50% of the population of the neighborhood are immigrants, and so. It's not uncommon for neo-Nazis to prey upon the neighborhood and come into the neighborhood and harass, beat up, or in certain instances firebomb local mosques, for example. But on Wednesday night, there was a killing. A 22-year-old Turkish person, from what I'm reading, was murdered, and two others were wounded. And this is quite suggestive of the environment, especially in Berlin right now. But overall, I think it is reflective of a crisis in Germany surrounding immigration and multiculturalism. Germany has been, for a number of years, turning into an immigrant society. It has a very low birth rate for quote-unquote indigenous Germans, and the business community has been actively soliciting and wooing foreign workers now for about a half a century. And so there are, if my memory serves me correctly, something like 4 million Muslims in the country who are descendants of Turks and Moroccans who have immigrated as guest workers over the last 50 years, largely Turkish in origin, if I'm correct. And it's very interesting. It's very ironic, especially if you're Jewish like me and live in Berlin and are historically self-conscious about the absent Jewish community. Having a strong community of Middle Eastern origin, in this case, for example, Turkish or Moroccan, is, makes you feel a lot safer and makes you feel a lot more at home in Germany. There is indeed safety in numbers, and it's good for Germany to be reminded that it's possible to redress much of the past by having a strong pro-immigration policy.
Now, there must be now second and even maybe third generation offspring of the original Turkish immigrants. Are they perceived as citizens or immigrants? How are they categorized?
This is a very good question. Yes, there are. There are at least third generation Turkish Germans that you can speak of. And there is a lot of discussion about the fact that many of them still do not feel properly integrated or welcomed, integrated into German society or welcomed by non-Turkish Germans. On the other hand, you also see, for example, hybridized versions of German and Semitic languages like Arabic. I was just reading of an Arabic-German equivalent to Yiddish that's being spoken in my neighborhood and in Kreuzberg by Muslim youth, which is really interesting because it attests to the fact that these Muslim immigrants from the Middle East are putting down very deep roots in German culture and are rearticulating German identity. I think it can only serve Germany well if it learns how to accept these immigrants and integrate them, and at the same time, you know, recognize, for example, that these immigrants are multilingual and can draw on their cultural background to, you know, help articulate a new vision of Europe as it relates to the Middle East, for example. I don't see that happening, obviously, but I know there are a lot of Germans who are very concerned about this, and as Germany proactively seeks out skilled laborers from southern European countries who are frequently treated like Middle Easterners in northern Europe, such as people from Spain and Portugal and Greece, the Germans are going to be forced to negotiate these kinds of issues of difference more frequently. At the same time, repeated polls conducted by German research institutes and foundations suggest rising levels of intolerance for minorities by persons of quote-unquote ethnic German origin. So it's a very combustible situation.
And we only have about 30 seconds left, and I wanted to get a question in about Israel. Is Israel going to attack Iran anytime soon, yes or no?
The Americans really don't want them to. And the Israeli government is, under the leadership of Netanyahu, is very anxious to move forward. It's a very tense situation.
That was Joel Shalit, author of Israel versus Utopia from Akashic Books, and co-editor of a fine new webzine on culture and politics, Souciant, Souciant.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about Pakistan. That was some of the Saraband from Bach's Partita for Solo Flute, performed by Jean-Pierre Ampal. My next guest is Sadia Tour, who teaches sociology at the College of Staten Island, part of the City University of New York, and is author of The State of Islam, Culture and Cold War Politics in Pakistan from Pluto Press. The book came out last summer, so it's not hot off the presses, but unlike the bourgeois media, we're not obsessed with novelty here on Behind the News. Pakistan is, of course, much in the headlines. If you want to understand that country, Sadia Tour's book is a great introduction. Sadia Tour. So let's go back to the beginning of Pakistan, a country that has its origins in British imperial designs, right?
Mm-hmm.
It emerged also out of the way that Britain managed the Indian populations by creating ethnic groups and religious groups.
Right.
And then so Pakistan emerges from that strategy, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, that's a very long and complex history, but to just put it in very short terms, basically, the fact that the Pakistan movement was a movement of self-determination of Indian Muslims came out of the way in which Britain basically administered and ruled over India for 200-300 years, which was really about understanding India as being fundamentally composed of religious groups, which they called communities, religious communities. And so what happened is that when we enter sort of the late 19th, early 20th century and you start to see sort of political activity within India, you start to see a lot of politics coalesce around religious community because that has already been politicized. Those have been consolidated as sort of the fundamental features or units of Indian society.
Okay, so then Pakistan was created at the time of India.
Right.
1947.
Right.
But it was not, certainly not a clean division. All these religious divisions were not very clean.
No.
And so what happened in the immediate years after partition?
Well, partition itself was such a very confused period because for quite a while, independence was the 14th/15th of August 1947. And so partition as a process began around that period. But as late on as July of 1947, it was unclear which villages, which towns, which localities were going to fall on which side of the boundary. And so that made for a lot of confusion. And I think the biggest legacy of independence for us has been the violence that partition wrought, not just the violence that happened during the process of partition, but the kinds of violence, political and otherwise, that it enabled later. And so you had immense movements of people. Many of them moved thinking that partition was temporary and that they would soon be returning. And so you have these really heartrending stories of people, say Hindus in Lahore, for example. My grandmother used to tell me the story of how their Hindu neighbor gave them the keys to her house and said, I'm going to leave this with you. We'll be back soon to, either get our stuff or, we'll be back after things settle down. So nobody on the ground really had any idea that this was in any way, in any sense, permanent, and that the transfer of population was also permanent.
And so a nationalist project usually involves creating a homogeneity where it didn't exist before. Mm-hmm. So what was the process by which the government created this nation in the years right after the partition?
All, I think, polities have the option of going with more inclusive programs of national community, which includes obviously on the political level of maybe a federal system and other kinds of provisions to make sure that the inclusion of various groups and individuals is at the political level, at the cultural level, etc. Unfortunately, in Pakistan, the people in power, the groups in power, were so averse to any kind of democratic process, or they were unwilling to let go of power at any level. And so what resulted was a highly centralized government that insisted on a very unitary form of national community that they claimed was based on Islam. Now, what that meant was extremely complex and contradictory, and every political actor would have a very different vision of what Pakistan's basis in Islam meant. And in fact, one of the very famous commissions that came up with a report in following an incident of extreme religious-led violence against the Ahmadi community in 1954, the Munir Commission report did, a fabulous job of deconstructing the fact that even the ulema at that time did not seem to have a unitary view of what Islam meant, leave alone what it would mean to say that Pakistan was an Islamic country. But what that meant was that in practice, it became very convenient for the ruling clique at the center to use Islam or the idea of Islam as being the basis for Pakistani nationalism to undercut any claims of sort of ethnic communities. And so basically to undercut the idea of federalism, which had been sort of the basis of the idea of sort of how Pakistan was to be organized politically.
The new nation and government also fit very quickly into a Cold War paradigm, right? So there's a developmental state, classic Cold War line. So tell us about the role that Pakistan played in that conflict.
I think in the first few years, Liaquat Ali Khan was the first prime minister, kind of did join the non-aligned movement. But very quickly, Pakistan started to gravitate towards the U.S. in terms of the Cold War setup. The U.S. also was Pakistan's strategic sort of closeness to the USSR, and the fact that India was not as responsive as the U.S. would have liked to U.S. overtures basically began to play a greater and greater role in sort of the politics and economics of Pakistan. So the numerous security, mutual security pacts are signed in the early, mid-1950s. The first is 1954. And, of course, the timing is very important because it's right after what happens with Mossadegh in Iran. And so Pakistan is pulled into the Cold War ambit of being one of the bases for U.S. influence in the South Asian, Middle Eastern region. And the Pakistani state and the ruling clique are quite happy to do that because they themselves are fighting this battle against the democratic forces in their country, which their fight against those forces fit very neatly within the Cold War narrative of containing communism, because the Pakistani state was very fond of labeling every democratic demand, communist demand.
But there was a very strong left socialist tradition in Pakistan.
Yes, in South Asia, in the subcontinent. And the areas that became Pakistan, actually, except for perhaps East Bengal, which had a much more organic relationship even after partition with West Bengal, and that went for the East Bengal Communist Party as well. They were very much connected to the West Bengal Communist Party. But the areas that came to constitute West Pakistan were some of the most underdeveloped industrially and otherwise areas of what had been British India. So there hadn't been a whole lot of communist work in those parts of the Indian subcontinent, barring parts of the Punjab, including Lahore. And so when Pakistan was first formed in terms of labor and working class activism, there hadn't been a whole lot. There had been a lot of work done in the Punjab, which again was split, and in terms of the peasant movements. But Pakistan lost a lot of communists with partition as well, because many of them happened to be Sikh or Hindu. And I think the division of the Communist Party along communal lines really is one of the lesser discussed aspects of the communist politics of that period. But what happened is that the Communist Party then sent a whole lot of Muslim communists to Pakistan. So they formed the kind of nucleus of what was to become the left in West Pakistan anyway. Organizationally, that left was very small, virtually non-existent except for a few key places like the railways or the postal services, the government enterprises basically. But culturally, they had immense influence, especially in West Pakistan. In East Pakistan, the situation was different. There had been a lot of solid communist work in Bengal, and that kind of continued, that history continued even after partition.
And 50s, 60s developmental state, right? And,
right.
What successes or failures did that accomplish?
So the 60s, so 58 onwards, when you have Ayub Khan, he institutionalizes a development project that is completely under the designs of the U.S. The U.S. is developing, as you know, its own development project at this time that is geared to countering Soviet influence in the newly independent ex-colonial states. So the Harvard Advisory Group arrives in Pakistan in the late 50s, early 60s, and proceeds to institutionalize their doctrine of what they call functional inequality, right, which is classical economics, if you will, which is the idea that first you have to create the situation in which there is immense inequality and then everything will trickle down.
I noticed you quote Mahbub ul Haq, who later became famous for creating the Human Development
Index.
Yes,
the ironies of history,
yeah.
Right? But to answer your question, the sort of contradictions of that development project, as we've seen everywhere, is that on the one hand, because it was focused specifically on industrialization, it kind of ignored at that point agriculture. What it did was create a huge industrial proletariat in Pakistan for the first time. So the problems that I was pointing out that the left had in the immediate aftermath of independence in West Pakistan were overcome by the fact that by the mid-60s, you not only had immense inequality, but you also had the evolution of a huge industrial proletariat that was becoming more and more conscious of their rights and willing to organize.
I'm speaking with Sadi Atur, who teaches sociology at the College of Staten Island and is author of The State of Islam, a history of Pakistan, which is out from Pluto. And since this is radio, we have to skip over a bunch of material. The Bhutto years, what were they like? Where did he come from and what were they like?
Well, Bhutto was Ayub Khan's defense minister, or actually foreign minister. And he was very much a part of the establishment, especially the defense establishment. From his very earliest years as a politician, exemplified sort of this anti-Indian chauvinism, but also had this strange rhetoric of anti-imperialism, which basically amounted to standing up to the U.S. in the U.N. Security Council and things like that, which gave him a certain cachet within Pakistan. So when the sort of movement against Ayub Khan starts to heat up in the mid-60s, he starts to realize that the wind is about to shift. And so he creates his own party, the Pakistan People's Party, and because he realizes that the shift really is leftwards, because the 60s, the mid to late 60s were a period of immense organizing on the left in terms of peasant movements, in terms of the industrial proletariat.
This is a worldwide wave of this.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So Pakistan is very much part of that worldwide wave. So Bhutto basically rides the tide, unfortunately, of that that left movement and the left militancy, because he manages to cobble together a political party that has a lot of institutional support. And it has that institutional support because Bhutto is always understood as a member of the establishment by various parts of the army. And the army has always, you know, played, since the mid to late 50s at least, played an immense role in Pakistani politics and society. So when you have 71, the elections of 1970, which are the first national elections to take place, and by all accounts,
ever since 1947.
Fair, ever since 1947. And you know, that tells you a lot about how it is that the small ruling clique, the establishment at the center, how hard they tried to hold on to power and how worried they were about their tenuous hold on power. They knew that the minute they had elections of any sort, they would lose all claim to power. But anyway, so the elections, which were by all accounts fair, led to Mujibur Rahman, who was an East Bengali politician, basically winning the most seats combined in East and West Pakistan. But the People's Party winning the most seats in West Pakistan. They actually didn't win anything in East Pakistan. And Bhutto put his foot down, and he was able to do this because, again, he had the army establishment behind him to say that there was no way that he was handing power over to Mujibur Rahman. And so you had this stalemate, which the army tried to, you know, broker, and by a very complicated set of developments, basically what ended up happening is that the militancy and the movement for self-determination in East Bengal heats up as a result of this, and you have the creation of Bangladesh. And basically what gets left as Pakistan is what used to be West Pakistan before. So it is culturally and otherwise a completely different beast from the first 23, 24 years of its existence. I think at this period in the 70s, when Bhutto is in power, you really start to see his actual politics. And he tries to manage. It's interesting. It's a fabulously interesting period in Pakistani history because you have a party and the party's chairman who basically constantly deploys the rhetoric and discourse and performance of communism and socialism, like international communism and socialism. The fact he calls himself the chairman, the fact that, you know, his sayings are also distributed in little red notebooks. I mean, it's really at the level of absurdity. But basically, his politics is a populist one because there is this rhetoric of socialism and labor rights and the rights of the people, but then there's the reality of his cracking down from the very beginning. You have this bizarre scenario in which he is the first elected prime minister, but he is also, you know, institutionally an authoritarian figure. And so you have this constant back and forth. So secularism was very much part of his mandate. Secularism and socialism were the two rhetorical sort of crutches that the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, used. But his politics on the ground were, except for these minimum labor reforms, were basically about undercutting the power of the organized left. And so immediately after he comes to power, he purges his party of the first the radical left, and then after that even the moderate socialists in his party. And it essentially becomes, for all intents and purposes, yet another authoritarian regime. Even the nominal socialism that he espouses, combined with the secularism that his government and his administration are also very strongly supporting, are anathema for the military and for the sort of the new rising conservative classes, middle classes in Pakistan.
And so there's a coup.
And so there's a coup.
That ushered in a really miserable period, right?
Yeah. Ziaul Haq, yeah. This is for a country that has already had several years of a previous military establishment. So, you know, 58 to 68, 69, so 10 years of Ayub Khan. And then, of course, various forms of a civilian military kind of authoritarian regime under Bhutto. The Ziaul Haq period is brutal because this is now an army that has literally tasted blood in East Bengal during, you know, the army operation against the Bengali militants, has also engaged in a very brutal crushing of an uprising in Balochistan in the 1970s under Bhutto. It is not the army of Ayub Khan, you know, which at least in its overt form was urbane and English-speaking and secular and modernist in outlook in the sense of modernization theory, right? I mean, clearly not democratic or anything like that, but definitely secular. This is now an army which is representing this new demographic change within the armed forces themselves, right? They're very greatly influenced by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and that has happened for lots of reasons, but in large part because under Bhutto, because the U.S. had cut off relations with Pakistan with the development of Pakistan's nuclear program under Bhutto. Bhutto turned to the Gulf states, which at this time were flush with oil money. And so Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states basically came to have a great say in the domestic and foreign policy of Pakistan. And the relationship between the military, the Pakistan military, and these Gulf states also became cemented at this time. So the mercen- you know, if you sort of read the between the lines in terms of what's happening in the Middle East today, the various Arab Springs, you see that Pakistani soldiers are consistently sent to places like Bahrain to quell the uprisings. And that has a very long history of that kind of mercenary relationship between the Pakistani military and these Gulf Arab states and Saudi Arabia.
Now, the Zia years were a period of a time of, what you could say, Islamization,
yes.
Militarization of the society,
yes.
And also a masculinization.
Yes.
So how did all work out?
Well, it worked out because the version of Islam that Zia sought to institutionalize, which was again coming from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, was an incredibly masculinist enterprise and an incredibly violent one. So these two things came together in the whole program of training jihadis to fight the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And so that's an incredibly important aspect of what happened under Zia and the U.S. role in sort of changing Pakistani society, because what it did was enable those ideas, those same ideas that are being given to the Mujahideen in the training camps, are now also becoming part of state policy in Pakistan. At least, you know, that's the attempt. There are, of course, lots of ways in which that was resisted across Pakistan, but the regime's oppression and its reaction to those resistances was also fairly brutal. So you had public lashings. This sort of introduction of these very medievalist kinds of punishments was done in a very explicit way, in a very strategic way, to really break the spirit of democracy and people's power in Pakistan. At that point, you had over a decade of left movements and even under Bhutto, sort of resistance to authoritarianism and movements for civil rights and civil liberties. And so, you know, one of the strategies of the army under Zia was to make sure that that history was completely abolished, that tradition of protest and dissidence was crushed. And this they tried to do, and I think did very successfully in some ways, unfortunately, by public lashings, by brutally torturing and rounding up dissidents and labor activists and, you know, people who are fighting for civil and democratic rights.
And then the war in Afghanistan.
Yes, the war in Afghanistan is happening all, you know, through all of this, basically, because 77 is when you have the coup and 79 is when basically the war begins. And it gives the Zia government, which has already for 2 years has been an incredibly repressive regime, it gives it this boost that it could not have possibly hoped for in terms of international standing, in terms of money, in terms of linkages. It now, you know, openly recognized and institutionalized and supported by the U.S. and the rest of the world, linkages with the worst kinds of Islamist ideologies, the worst kinds of Islamic politics, and money from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and the U.S., what have you.
And it's important to underscore that, you know, despite occasional rhetoric now, the U.S. was entirely behind this agenda.
Oh, yes. I mean, Tariq Ali pointed out many, many years ago how deeply involved the U.S. was in terms of right down to the fact that the textbooks that were used in the training camps of the Mujahideens were created in the U.S. So the connections are not just, oh, the U.S. gave money to the Pakistani military and the Pakistani military did bad things. No, the U.S. was very much part and parcel of the strategy. And that came right out of its sort of much older understanding of how Islam, or political Islam in particular, and a certain kind of radical Islam could be deployed against international communism. And so they had a history, the CIA had a history of supporting the worst kinds of political and radical Islamists from the 1950s onwards in various places in the Muslim world. And so this was just sort of the coming to fruition of all of that.
I'm speaking with Sadia Tour, who teaches sociology at the College of Staten Island and is author of The State of Islam, a history of Pakistan, which is out from Pluto. And now another fast forward, Musharraf comes to power in 99, was it?
99.
A lot of liberals welcomed him, right? Because he was an alternative to the Taliban, right?
To Talibanization, which from the 1990s has been from basically from the time that the Taliban took over power in Afghanistan, I think they have been the bogeyman for the Pakistani liberals. I mean, at one level, the worry that secularism is being undermined and that the state is deploying religion has a basis. I mean, that is what Ziaul Haq definitely did, and that is what all the new crop of politicians, particularly Nawaz Sharif, that Ziaul Haq created to pass on, you know, his legacy and to undermine the People's Party, you know, was all about using Islam and this, again, this very virulent form of Islam, because there are forms of Islam, of course, that are very closely aligned with social justice and are very much about Unitarianism, what we would understand be Unitarianism in the U.S. You know, there's Sufi shrines that combine a very synthetic form of Islam and Hinduism. So, you know, it's not as if it's Islam itself that's the problem, which is what we have to consistently sort of say. It's this particular version of Islam that became institutionalized in Pakistan that has always been the problem. And so that fight is there. I mean, I don't want to sort of undercut the fact that that is a very present danger in some ways. But the problem has been that Pakistani liberals have, perhaps I think because of what happened under Zia, narrowed their focus down to this being the only problem, the imminent Talibanization of Pakistan, right? Not just Islamization, but Talibanization of Pakistan. And that became, this term Talibanization is so broad and so vague, right? So any sort of move towards Islam becomes red in that way. But again, I mean, I think the fight for secularism is a very valid fight. The question is, what are you willing to give up in order to fight this fight, right? If this is your sole focus. And what Pakistani liberals have shown, and I think this is true of liberals in other parts of the quote-unquote Muslim world as well. I mean, Algeria comes to mind in terms of Algerian feminists and the kinds of stands that they have taken as well in terms of democracy and the fear of democracy. You have the same kinds of fears in Pakistan. So there's this constant fear that, you know, not democracy, because there is this understanding in Pakistan that the Islamist parties do not have a popular base that way. They never win in elections. But there is this fear of their influence within society. And also their use by various governments. So the Nawaz Sharif government, for example, there's no question about the fact that the Nawaz Sharif government was trying to force through a Sharia bill in the late 1990s, around the time that the coup happened, and that the Muslim League's minister social welfare in the Punjab had started really this crusade, if you will, against feminist NGOs. So it's within this context that the coup in 1999 happens. And that's the context in which you see all of these liberals, who by now are mostly involved in and running their own NGOs of one sort or another, welcoming Musharraf. And welcoming him in the most absurd, depoliticized, structural kind of ways for being basically a modern person himself, like as an individual.
Well, he came across on TV as a very urbane.
Exactly. So it's sort of this throwback to the old urbane military ruler, Ayub Khan. And this is absurd. I mean, I sat in on the meeting that happened immediately after the coup in Lahore, in which the Joint Action Committee, which is an umbrella group of several civil society groups in Lahore, I was one of a very small minority of people saying that the coup is horrible. You know, regardless of what kind of democracy we had and how awful Nawaz Sharif was, the fact is that that was a democracy. And to have a military dictatorship is never a good idea on purely, you know, principal terms and being completely shouted down by people who saw their interest as being completely opposed to that of the Nawaz Sharif government, therefore democracy at that time, and completely in line with Musharraf.
So it's either Musharraf or the Taliban.
Yes, that was basically what it was. So and now it's like either the army or the Taliban. Even though everybody has to know the deep connections between the Taliban and the Pakistani army.
I want to conclude on all this, like, just looking at the present state of Pakistan, it's clear they sheltered Osama bin Laden, mm-hmm. or at least portions mm-hmm. of the army and the mm-hmm. intelligence establishment did. And at the same time, they're trying to play like they're America's ally.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on there? How do you read the real interest, or is it divided, or is there a logic to it all that we can't see?
I mean, the Pakistani army's interest, for better or for worse, is that they see their primary enemy as India. And everything that the Pakistani military does has to be read against that backdrop. And so for them, everything that happened in Afghanistan, you know, from 1979 onwards, has been about using Afghanistan as, using that leverage against India, basically, right? And so you had this policy in which, because of the kinds of relationships and the institutionalized relationship that developed under the Afghan War of the 1970s and 1980s, you had the Pakistani military develop a very strong set of interests in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, it sort of saw the Taliban as its people in Afghanistan, right, as a way to counter the threat against India. And that is the only issue at stake. So the Pakistani military and the ISI constantly have created and armed and trained militant jihadist groups for war in Kashmir. That has been their main basis, for the main interest. They are coming into this relationship with the U.S. in 2001 with these interests at stake. And they did not want to be part of this alliance with the U.S., but Bush basically famously gave the ultimatum that if you don't want to be blown back into the Middle Ages or the Stone Ages, you have to side with us. And so from the very beginning, the relationship with the U.S., the alliance with the U.S. was very shaky, right? Because you have one set of interests that the Pakistani military has, and you have another set of interests that the U.S. has in Afghanistan. And they converge at places, but they diverge as well. And so, you know, to sort of not understand this, when you look at when the Pakistani military or the Pakistani state does things that are not entirely in line with U.S. interests, and then to sort of then only read that in terms of a certain mendaciousness or essentialist kind of duplicity, is, I think, incredibly dangerous. I mean, I think if the U.S. security establishment is interested in having an alliance, a very limited alliance with Pakistan, it has to at least come to terms with the fact that Pakistani interests or state interests are never going to line up completely with U.S. state interests, right?
Finally, are there any hopeful forces in Pakistan? I mean, you have a society that's totally militarized, the military consuming enormous amounts of resources, high poverty, low levels of human development. Any hopeful forces politically?
There are a lot of very interesting positive developments that have been happening in Pakistan over the last few years. At the purely sort of level of formal politics, despite the fact that the Pakistan People's Party is a very flawed party and is not at all socialist, you know, even its rhetoric is so absurd now, the fact of the matter is that this is the first sort of period of democratic government in a long time that has actually delivered in some very interesting ways. So the passage of, for example, the 18th Amendment, which really devolved a lot of powers to the provinces, which has been one of the main demands of the smaller provinces against Punjab and the central government, was a hugely positive step. And for them to do that in an atmosphere in which the politics, I mean, if we think that Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. are, that politics is contentious, the politics between the political parties in Pakistan is also completely out of control in terms of them refusing to usually find any common ground, right? So the fact that they have managed to actually pass certain amendments to the Constitution, pass certain policies that are actually progressive, you know, with all their flaws as well. I think that speaks to the fact that if allowed, a more robust democracy or democratic framework can develop in Pakistan. right? But of course, you know, when we talk about democracy, we don't want to just talk about formal democratic electoral politics. We also want to talk about sort of empowerment of people on the ground and of particular kinds of people, such as minorities, religious minorities, women, and the working classes and the peasant classes. Pakistan is still a majority agricultural country. And the fact of some very militant movements emerging amongst peasant groups, I think, is a very hopeful sign. The fact that you have a strong, million-strong peasant movement in the Punjab, which is Pakistan's most populous province, against the military, I think, is a very hopeful sign. The other sort of more hopeful things that are emerging are other kinds of mobilizations by various working people. So, for example, the labor commie movement in Faisalabad, which is the second biggest city in Punjab and sort of the hub of the textile industry. So you have these textile workers, power loom workers, which are incredibly exploited, living at the brink of poverty, coming together to form an incredibly militant movement, again coming, you know, sort of head-to-head with the powers that be, and having to deal with the fact that Pakistan, the state, regularly uses anti-terrorism laws against labor activists, including democratic activists. So you have all of these movements for greater rights that are not sort of being crushed easily by state repression, which is always sort of there. And I think that really is where we should focus on if we're looking for sort of future of Pakistan.
That was Sadia Tour, who teaches sociology at the College of Staten Island, part of the City University of New York, and author of The State of Islam, Culture and Cold War Politics in Pakistan, recently out from Pluto Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Silkworm's Into the Woods. Bye.
Come on, honey, it's time for some time away. We have the technology today. Instead of using the prison to try to get your feet up. We'll go into the woods and live with the bears. Is that where you can kill someone and nobody cares? And when you've got something, it's time to ascend into heaven. Then we'll use your bone, and if your bone's not enough, then we'll use my lyrical homicide, and if my drum's not enough, then we'll use somehow. Oh, come on, honey, let's play with the matches. You bought a new set just in time.